Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 yes. FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. We have regular guest speakers, and this week and indeed every first Saturday of the month, it's Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. This week he'll be talking about the Milky Way. Ooh. Also a bit about Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society Solar Sundays, one last week at their observatory. I think there's one coming up at the end of June at Old Moor, so we'll be talking about that later. RPG, we'll be speaking to him later in this hour. He's talking about Africa, interestingly enough. But in the science news this week...
Before I start, although it's very cold outside and wet, this story is about the year 2022, when Britain broke the 40 degrees Celsius barrier and train lines melted. It became clear that our temperate summers were over. Last month, a heat spike, which shot in a few days from 12 degrees Celsius to 33 degrees Celsius, gave us our earliest ever tropical night, which is above 20 degrees Celsius. Leading scientists are now calling for the UK to adapt its working hours, hospitals and homes accordingly to future-proof our country against ever-rising temperatures.
Doesn't feel like it today because it's raining, but we need the rain. But talking of rising temperatures, last year was the strongest year on record for solar expansion in the UK, according to new government figures. Nearly 270,000 installations were completed, a rise of 37% from the year before, while 9 out of 10 strongest months for solar deployment occurred in the past year.
Meanwhile, it is well documented that bees suffer during periods of extreme heat and are prone to bouts of dehydration and exhaustion. But new research shows that it can also have a severe effect on their fertility. A group of scientists from the University of Hull found that in both male and female bees, heat wave conditions damage sperm and egg activity.
Interesting. Elsewhere in the news, Thames Water caused almost a third of the water sector's most harmful pollution incidents in 2025, marking a dire year for England's waterways, according to official figures.
Right. Save ghost woods to let dormant fairy forests grow again. Ghost woods are the remnants of England's ancient woodlands and are some of the country's oldest living ecosystems. Dame Judy Dench is part of a growing campaign to recognise these lost woods and restore them to their former glory.
All interesting stuff. Of course, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're here every week from 11 till 12 talking about science in all its different forms. And we'll continue the theme of vegetables and health benefits. Next up, tomatoes. I'm just looking at Paul here because he's covering the desk. A technical issue there. One word for tomatoes, lycopene. Tomatoes are packed with this powerful carotenoid, a substance that gives tomatoes their red colour and is understood to reduce the risk of heart disease. Some studies have also shown a link between lycopene and lowered blood pressure and cholesterol, plus a lower risk of prostate cancer. Lycopene becomes more bioavailable when cooked, meaning that your body can absorb more lycopene from a cooked tomato than a raw one. This almost makes a pizza a healthier choice than a salad. There's more lycopene in the skin than the pulp, so leave the skin on tomatoes. Then you're also getting extra fiber from the skin. Tomatoes are also a good source of vitamin C and potassium. And yes, we know they're technically a fruit and not a vegetable. Next up is cauliflower. This is one of the best vegetable sources of a lesser-known nutrient called choline, C-H-O-L-I-N-E, which is vital for brain development. It's also found in eggs, beef, fish and chicken. We're increasingly finding out about choline's importance to the brain to help with our mood and memory. Cauliflower is also high in fiber and potassium, important for blood pressure regulation and a source of sulforaphane, a potent antioxidant. None of these names are easy to say ever. Good news then for cauliflowers. If you love your cauliflower cheese, there's a place for it in a balanced diet. And while the cheese sauce adds calories and fat, it won't destroy cauliflower's other health benefits and bring some calcium as well. However, this article suggests you put a little bit of really strong cheddar or parmesan or even Stilton on your cauliflower cheese instead of blanketing it with lots of milder cheddar. Think of it, the cheese as a garnish. The main event is, of course, the cauliflower itself. Then we move on to potatoes. The UK's best-selling veg gets a bad press compared with its peers. But if you branch out from chips and crisps, potatoes are actually pretty good for you. Potatoes are often misunderstood. They're rich in potassium, which is important for blood pressure regulation, and they provide vitamin C. Much depends on how you cook them, of course. The gulf between a French fry and a skin-on baked spud is almost as wide as that between a carrot and a cheesy Watsit. Brilliant article. Potato skins contain fibre, so keep them on if you can, and bake or boil. If you let cooked potatoes cool before eating, they are also a source of resistant starch, which is great for gut health. Sweet potatoes are only a distant relative of the regular spud and not a top 10 bestseller, but do eat them. They are a great source of vitamin C, fibre and beta carotene. Have I got enough time to talk about onions and green beans? I think I have. Onions, they do contain some goodies, but because they're usually eaten in small quantities, their nutrient contribution to most diets is modest. But they do provide some vitamin C and fibre, as well as quercetin and other polyphenols with anti-inflammatory effects. Onions also score points for adding flavour to infinite dishes, helping to reduce our reliance on salt, which is always a good thing. Giving onions a long, slow cook makes them easier to digest. And don't forget spring onions. The green part contains more vitamin C than regular onions and more vitamin K and folate. When you eat them raw, the vitamin C levels are better preserved. And finally, green beans. Fresh beans, greens, stringless, runner and broad are all a versatile group of vegetables that contain moderate amounts of fibre as well as vitamin C, folate and potassium. The pick of the bunch are broad beans. They're higher in protein because it's concentrated in the beans themselves, not the pods. The dried pulses have even more protein than fresh beans. Interesting. And they're a decent source of resistant starch. Overcooking can reduce their vitamin C levels, but no one wants a mushy bean anyway. There you go. Bit of an excess there. Taste It, of course, because we're talking about the benefits of vegetables, tomatoes, cauliflower, potatoes, onions and green beans. You're listening to Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. RPG should be on the line. Good morning, PG.
Well, yeah, soggy, but yeah,
soggy. What's happened to summer, eh? I bet you wish you were in Africa or somewhere warmer, maybe.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm not quite so sure about that.
Well, but I wondered, because you did say you were going to talk about Africa today, so what's caught your eye then in the science news?
Well, something that keeps popping up in recent days, and I thought I'd do a bit of a follow-up, but it's about the development of a split of the African continent that's in progress. And you sort of wonder about it a little bit, because it's like all the horror movies that come out, isn't it, where the world's falling apart. So this is really, it's an article that came out of CNN, the broadcaster. And it said that in the northern region of Ethiopia, there's a region called the Afar region, and it's the centre of a Y-shaped rift system. And eventually this will split the continent to form a new ocean. So, yeah, oh, crikey, you know, for people in Africa, I guess that's going to be a worry. So I was reading on a bit, they're saying that basically the region that it's in, the Afar region, is one of the driest and hottest areas on the planet. They can get summer temperatures which reach over 50 degrees Celsius or 122 Fahrenheit. And it's the home to the Erta Ale volcano. That's in the Danakil Depression with a decades-old lava lake that's formed, which is quite rare these days. And locally, it's called the Gateway to Hell.
Oh, my word. Perhaps you don't want to be in Africa then, this bit.
It sits at the juncture of three big tectonic plates, the African plate, the Arabian plate, and the Nubian plate, I think it is. And really, if you look, it's one of those things that we've talked about before, where, you know, we think we're on good old solid Earth, but it's actually continually on the move. And on the three rifts that are there, there's the main one is the Ethiopian Rift, then you've got the Gulf of Aden Rift and the Red Sea Rift, which come together in this region of Africa, and they're continually drifting. So just to sort of put people's minds at the movement, I think in two of the rifts is actually 15 millimetres a year, which is slower than your nails grow, apparently. Yeah. the main Ethiopian rift is even slower, at 5 millimetres per year. It's one of those inexorable movements that happen under our feet. It's moving slowly, but eventually this area is going to become a new ocean floor. So as these plates start to move further and further apart, which could take millions of years, then really you're sort of looking forward to a change of the planet. And I think if we go back in time, then you come to things like the supercontinent of Gaia, where really Africa came away from South America. So if you actually look at the contours vaguely, it's a little bit like the UK. If you look at the contours of adjoining land, you can kind of find the similarity of shape where slowly those areas have drifted apart. So a localised version of what's happening here, I guess, is what happened to create the English Channel and the North Sea. Dogger Bank used to be land.
Yeah, you could walk from Europe into Britain, couldn't you? Which is astounding when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that sort of excited scientists about this area in Africa is that basically it's exposing very old sedimentary layers, which really sort of go back 5 million years. And they found fossils there of extinct human relatives back to something like 2.6 million years ago. It kind of raised a question for me about what did I actually know about Africa. And I think, like a lot of us, I didn't actually know a lot. That's all right, I'm just typing as I talk. Oh, yes, yeah. And I've fallen off on the bicycle while I did it. I think you look at this kind of movement and you can see that in Africa, potentially there's a change. But this is really, Ethiopia is up in the top right-hand corner of Africa. And if you look at the map of the African continent, it starts on the north side with the Mediterranean and comes around to the Gibraltar Strait, and you can see the sort of linkage there. But then it comes round to the west coast, which is, as I say, something where you can see the correlation to the Americas of that shape of the coast. Down to the south and then round to the east. And as you come up the eastern side of Africa, you get to what's called the Horn of Africa. And above that, right in the northern corner, is this Ethiopian area. And really, sort of looking at Africa as a whole, we've often talked about the origins of humanity and the potential for it coming from fairly southern Africa and progressing up generally the eastern coast of Africa to come through the Middle East and eventually through into Europe. And so our relationship goes back to that route. And you sort of looking at that and thinking, well, what's the status of Africa today? And quite often it's quite muddy. You know, there's a sort of a history of conquest, war, and various other sort of movements where Africa has been at the sort of butt end of other people's wants and aspirations. And a lot of things you can sort of look at today. In the northern part, there is generally a shortage of electricity supply. And yet we see a modern sort of solar farm developing to export electricity from Africa into Europe, potentially. They see that as a way of generating income because they've got constant sunshine, and they build a system where they focus that to generate heat, to drive the turbines, to create electricity. But we've talked about other areas in Africa where they have to use batteries because they don't have power. So how sort of strange and an anomaly is it that they should be exporting solar power, electricity, potentially to make money? But within the continent itself, you've got such a diversity of access that you need to come up with systems where you can use battery storage systems to supply basic needs of electricity. And there's a lot of scientific research at the moment about the problems that that can cause for the developing nations. So it's really difficult for them because there's a call for electricity supplies, but there isn't the infrastructure, and that introduces lots of real world things like who will supply infrastructure and at what kind of cost. And you hear lots of arguments from different areas of the world about what should happen, but the African continent is where it happens. And personally, I've been close to the African continent, but I've not actually been in the lower part of the African continent. I've been into Egypt, which is the northern part. But for a lot of people, unless you can actually travel and see those areas, it's a bit storybookish to say, well, okay, what is going on? And realistically, it's a bit of a complex thing because it's a shared origin for people in Europe and other places around the world. And you look at it now, I think it's the second largest continent on Earth after Asia. It's got the lowest median age of population at something like 19.7 years.
Wow, yeah. Compared to ours, which is getting higher and higher, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the world average, I think, on that same measure was about 30.4. So there's a huge discrepancy. but it is sort of an area for renewal, for change, and you've got a diversity within the sort of continent of different countries at different stages of development, and strange anomalies like the Nile being such a massive long river complex that travels through different countries right from the heart of Africa out to the Mediterranean, and you sort of are looking at such a sort of patchwork. There are so many different countries and remnants of empire that are around. So you've got Mauritius and some islands like St. Helena, which is still related to the UK. So you've got all of those. The Canaries are off the coast of Africa. And realistically, it does beg a question of what we know. And underneath that, the world gets on with things like this development of a rift and changing the face of the planet. So the scale for science, I think, to put those into some kind of perspective is great. And I think it's a failure in general communication that we don't know a lot more about it. So science really needs to sort of get its act together a bit more, and really... We've done a lot of articles over our time with the science show of developments within Africa, and say with systems that are in use, development of agriculture, the scientific search for drought-resistant crops, and you can see that there's a lot of need in Africa, but it's a difficult place to actually supply those needs on a larger basis. And sadly, one of the reflections these days is the number of ongoing wars or conflicts that happen within that. And I think we've just got a reminder in Europe that it's not always that far away that conflict happens. And I think, say, it's interesting that we've got a shared origin within Africa, but not always a great idea of what it's about, what's happening, and what its future may be.
It's a massive country, though, Paul. I mean, we do go to Kenya, and we flew back, you know, early morning past Kilimanjaro, but for hours and hours, there was nothing beneath us, just deserts. And, you know, you get the real, you don't really realise what it's like until, we flew over a tiny bit of it. Some bits are developed, obviously, but it's a massive, massive country. I think Nigeria, possibly, I hate to think how many, the population is in Nigeria.
Yeah, that's it.
They're big, big countries.
Yeah, I think, as I say, one of the problems is that the north, it has got this sort of arid, dry region that a lot of the development areas are along the coast. I think just the name of Africa has got so many connections back to the Mediterranean movement, the Romans, the Greeks. There are a lot of ideas about where the root of the name Africa comes from. And it's got various sort of literal translations in different languages. So it's the place of wind, or the place of the wind that brings rain. I guess it's one of those enigmatic countries, and we've had Stanley and Livingstone, you know, the exploration, you see the impact of Europe in the lower half of the continent is basically mainly Christian, if you look at religion, because a lot of countries exported their religion two places that they were dealing with on the African continent. The northern belt is Islamic, generally. You have got a dash of Hindu and other sort of religions within the country. So, and it's really had a history of incoming people from other sort of areas, developed areas, who come to exploit the resources that were there, that really sort of developed a lot of these sort of empires that used to exist, that slowly have retracted from there. But again, the links for so much of it is the need for infrastructure, and that's sort of part of the soft power that a lot of countries apply to relations with Africa. They'll build bridges and they'll build roads and other things. You look at it as a political sort of boiling pot, really. Generally speaking, as I say, there's an awful lot of shared humanity. So it's kind of interesting. And I think underneath it all, there's a reminder that good old planet Earth is not just a solid rock.
No.
It is moving.
Well, Great Britain was once below the equator, which I still can't get my head around that. But
yeah, it's...
we got pushed, tectonic plates pushed us into the northern hemisphere. So it's not as daft as it sounds, is it?
No. It's and as I say, that's why scientists are getting excited in the areas like in Ethiopia, because it's also allowing us to look back at the history of humanity as well.
Indeed, and you've chosen a fantastic track, Paul.
Yeah, I think this is a little bit... Well, the one that I sort of toyed with was Carole King, I Feel the Earth Move.
Oh,
which
nice.
Is a brilliant track.
Yeah.
But then one which is a bit anthemic is Toto.
Yay!
In Africa.
Excellent. Yes. Brilliant, Paul. We'll speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show. Thank as you well, one till three. Bye bye.
Look
forward to it. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you.
Bit of class there, bit of Toto with Africa, because RPG was talking about Africa. Of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. We should have Phil Muffet on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball, a fireball.
Oh, very nice. Good morning, Phil.
Morning.
Good morning. Ooh. Have you dried out yet?
No, I'm still a bit damp.
You're crackers, man, running in this weather.
Yeah.
And as you told me, your Garmin's told you you've got to. It's going to take you 4 days to recover from that run. I'm not laughing. No. I'd get another Garmin if I were you. Change batteries, Phil. It can't be right, can it?
It's hard being an athlete.
I know. Well, you were telling me you've been too busy dragon boating and winning things.
All last month, it was all dragon boating last month, and I'm not being able to run. I haven't had time, and to be honest, last week I noticed that I've not been running, so I've had to like get back into it. But it means I've overstretched myself.
Overstretched yourself. Feet up for the rest of the day, Phil.
I've gone in too hard.
And it's raining outside, so there's no gardening to do today for you. No, just stay in.
No grass cutting. Oh. Just a bit of dusting. Just a bit of dusting.
Very good, very good. So, first of all, let's talk about the Mexican Swinton Astronomical Society. So, the Sunday last week at your observatory up at Hoover.
Okay, we had quite a few telescopes out last week, but we only had about a dozen members of the public turn up.
Well, that's unusual, isn't it? Because normally you're like overwhelmed.
Yes. So, I suppose really when you get too many people turn up, it kind of makes it a bit tricky looking through telescopes. But we've got like telescopes with filters on so we can look at the sun safely. So it's good. Don't do it yourself unless you absolutely know what you're doing. We've got like proper filters to look at the sun in different wavelengths with expert opinions on what you're looking at. So, we do it all safely, but you need to do it with somebody who knows what they're doing.
Did the sun actually come out last Saturday? Sunday, wasn't it?
Photos. Yeah, I think I'm sure they got a couple of photos. I wasn't there because I was off doing something else. In fact, I were dragon boating. It was quite. There's some nice photos on Facebook.
And people learnt things they didn't know about, I guess.
Always, every day's a learning.
But it's a fantastic observatory, though. If you've never been up there, it's near Hoover Stand, isn't it? You can't miss it because it's got a big white dome.
We love it. You see, a lot of clubs don't have ideal situations for observatories. But I think we've got a really good spot.
You're high up, aren't you?
We're near no buildings, and we're high up, highest place in Rotherham. So we've got like good vistas over the countryside, and we can see down to the horizon, which is always useful.
Yeah, and there's not that much light pollution.
It's reasonable. We're right in the middle of Rotherham, Sheffield, Barnsley, Doncaster. So there is a bit of sky glow around the horizon, but where we are, It does make a difference. Somebody did some photography last week from the observatory, and his photos from the observatory was remarkably different to what it did in his back garden. He had a sea star, 50mm sea star, and his photographs were way better from the observatory.
Just because less light pollution.
Less light pollution, yeah.
Interesting. We won't talk about your back garden at this point, Phil, and that street light. That's a bane of your life.
It is, but I am learning to deal with it because I've got different techniques on with it. Well,
like cardboard.
Yes, I've developed a pole. I've got a big aluminium pole now I can stick in my garden with a big sheet of foam attached to the top of it, like a big solar panel. And if I get in the right spot, it casts a right big shadow over my garden. The only problem is, if you forget to put it away at night time,
it's illegal.
My wife is like, what the hell have you done to the back garden?
I bet you're popular with your neighbours, Phil, aren't you? Eh?
It does look a bit odd.
You're building your observatory, aren't you, as well?
Yeah, I'm building a shed for me.
Brilliant. So you should have had, the club should have had an event at Old Moor. Is it next Sunday?
Now then, the old Moor is down to the 28th.
Oh, it's the 28th?
28th.
Is that because the forecast for next week wasn't good?
Well, we booked it out in advance, so it's been booked in for quite some time now.
So that's generally 11 till 3, isn't it? Old Moor, yeah, RSBB site.
Then people are going to look at Nature Reserve as well.
Oh, you're breaking up a bit there, Phil. I don't know what you're doing.
Sorry.
That's better. I heard him. Yeah. But yeah, so it's at Old Moor, which is the RSPB reserve in Dearne Valley.
Yeah.
And it's 11 till 3, I believe, on Sunday the 28th of June. And do you have to pay to get into the reserve, or is it in the courtyard?
Yes. Well, if you get into the courtyard, but if you go on to the reserve, I think if you're not a member, I think...
You have to pay. But just to go and see you lot's worth it, isn't it, eh?
We do it in the courtyard so people can get to see us,
But as you know, it's all weather dependent, isn't it? So if it's a miserable day, it's a bit disappointing.
Yeah. We still tend to turn up. And it's always good. You can chat to people, advice, how do you do all this, how do you do all that, so
It's worth it anyway, so we'll keep an eye out for that. So is that, you don't have to book that, you just turn up?
No, people just turn up.
Excellent. So we spoke to you last week, Phil, and you mentioned the Milky Way with probably one of the best stories you've ever told on live radio about...
Which was that?
When you were on a cruise ship and you went out at night, tripped over a lilo and cut your leg, but while you were laid on the floor in agony, mopping your blood up, you noticed the Milky Way.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell us more about... What do you know about the Milky Way?
So we're coming round to that time of the year where the centre of the galaxy is coming round to the southern horizon. So it's rising, and it should be about due south, roughly about 12 o'clock at night time during this month. Now we're about 25,000 light years, 30,000 light years from the centre of the galaxy. I think it's about 10,000, the central bulge of the galaxy, I think it's about 10,000 light years across. Now, it tends to give a glow in the southern horizon. That's if you can see past the streetlights. If you're out in the countryside, it will be more noticeable. But then, as you kind of look up and across to the east, the spiral arm goes out across the sky through Cygnus as it's climbing through the sky, and out through Cassiopeia and across the top of Perseus and then over towards Aquila. So we can kind of see out through the spiral arm of the galaxy, which is really incredible, because what we find is in the spiral arm of the galaxy, we get a lot of star formation. There's a lot of gas, a lot of dust, and it's where there's a lot of clusters and star clouds that are forming like new stars. And long exposure photography reveals some absolutely terrific star, cloud patterns in the sky, like the North American Nebula. So yeah, it's a really good place to look. Lots of star clusters, and lots of a bright nebula. So yeah, it's really spectacular. There's lots of mesier objects in this part of the sky as well, especially around Sagittarius and Cygnus. Some lovely stuff.
So if you've never seen the Milky Way, I've seen it once in Greece, once in sort of near Beverly, because the sky, the pollution, there's no street lights in that area, and the sky was so clear, you can't fail to miss this. Like, it's just a big, it's like a streak, but it's not a thin streak, is it? It's quite a thick.
Quite wide. And the darker it is, the wider it is as well.
Around
Sagittarius it's quite wide, and then as it gets higher in the sky up towards Cygnus, it thins out a bit, but you're actually looking out through the actual spiral arm of the galaxy.
And is that what the Milky Way is then?
Yeah, that's right.
And what does spiral arm mean? What does that mean?
So when you look at our galaxy, we're in a spiral galaxy, so we've got like a central hub. I always think it's a bit like a fried egg in a frying pan. So the centre bit is the bulge, and then the white bit is the spiral arms that go out. So the galaxy is spinning on an axis, a bit like the sun in our solar system. But what happens is the material radiates out from the centre of the galaxy in a spiral, and the spiral is spinning round together in one piece. So if you look at photographs of other galaxies, you get these, like, they look like a Catherine wheel that's spinning, where the, you know, you see where the sparks are going out in a curve from the centre of the galaxy. That's a spiral arm. So in them spiral arms, it's a concentration of gas and dust, which go to form stars. So you get a lot of star formation, a lot of clusters, and it's a higher concentration of stars. So the milkiness you see is a combination of all the light from the stars that you can't see.
Now, wow.
When you take a photograph, the higher resolution you can get, the more and more and more stars you can see. So if you, for instance, were going to take a, it's like in the constellation Lyra, which is just outside, it's just above the plane of the spiral arm. There's a well-known planetary nebula called the Ring Nebula, and it's just above the arm. Now, when you look at it with binoculars, there's quite a lot of stars, but if you take a photograph of that object, the background is absolutely littered with stars. Wow. The closer you get to Cygnus, the amount of stars that are there start to come out, and the longer you take a photograph, the more and more and more stars you see. So what you're doing is you're seeing with your eyes, you're seeing an accumulation of the light from the stars, but you don't actually see all the stars. You can only see the stars and resolve the stars that are closer to us in a spiral arm. But if you do a long exposure photograph, you can actually start and see all that lightness in the background. It's a bit like a cloud, is like a combination of all the light from the stars, but you just can't resolve it with your eyes.
So the milkiness I didn't understand that, because you do look at it and you can see some bits, but
it's concentration
just
of starlight.
Yeah, and is it always there? Is it always in the sky?
It's always there. But remember, as the seasons move round, the Milky Way moves with the constellations, so it's not in the same place all year, so it moves around the sky.
Is that why you're saying this time of year is a good time to see, because it's in the southern horizon?
So the central bulge is close to the equator, so you're only going to see it at this time of year for 1 or 2 months in the summer, and it's low to our horizon at our latitude. So I reckon, so I've got a gap in my hedge and the trees across the road, and I can see due south, and I can probably see an hour either side of the meridian. So this next month, and well, actually these next 2 months, I'm going to be looking at the constellation of Scorpius, which is just above the hedge, and I'm going to be looking at the constellation of Sagittarius, where the galactic center is, which will be just above my hedge. And there's lots of clusters and nebula in that area. So round about midnight, if I get some clear nights, I'll have about an hour where I can possibly catch some objects. So I'm looking at some objects I've not seen
so
before.
have you ever tried to photograph the Milky Way then?
If you use a camera, like a 28mm Canon lens on a DSLR camera, and do a 30-second exposure of the sky, you'll pick out the Milky Way. You'll get the stars, and you'll get the Milky Way in the background. But you want to make sure you've got no streetlight affecting your lens. You want a nice dark spot in your garden where you can't see your streetlights, and you'll be able to pick up the Milky Way in a 30-second exposure.
Wow! So would you do that with your telescope, though?
What I'll be doing is I'll be looking for some of these objects that are in the spiral arm.
Okay.
Like the Amiga Nebula.
You're trying to nail down the individual bits.
Formations, because there's some really interesting star and gas clouds in that part of the sky. So some of them I've never seen before. Well, now with my newer telescope, I'll be able to actually get photographs from
all you need is your new observatory now. Finished.
Yeah. So I've painted it now. I'm up to my roof level.
Really? Wow. Yeah, yeah. You don't mess around, Phil, do you?
It took me 2 months to put it together.
Wow.
But my roof, I'm going to put a roof on it next, And then I'm going to have to work on a lid to keep the weather out.
Brilliant. Going back to your hedge in your garden, right? Have you cut it such that it helps you with astronomy? No, it sounded like it to me.
Well, it's just worked out right. However, I have had to trim my tree because my cherry tree's been filling the gap.
Yeah.
But there's a tree across the road from where we live, and it's going to have to
go.
I'm going to take a bow saw to it.
Is it your tree, Phil? Is it your tree?
It's one of these self-setting trees in a hedge.
Oh, is it? Oh, we'll let that off then.
And I think what I'm going to do is, one night, I'm going to trim a couple of branches off it.
Wow. But no, I just found that really interesting because that point, if you look through that gap in your hedge, you know that's due south.
That's right.
I think that's clever.
A lot of observatories have like a north-south meridian that goes like through them. Like Greenwich used to keep time, they had a north-south meridian that they used to, as it transits, it's the highest point in the sky, and that's when they did their observations. And I've got the same kind of event in my garden. I've got a space where I can be, and I can see due south. And I've got about a good hour's view right down to the horizon. But that's it. So they pop out the trees, I can see them, and then they pop back into the trees.
Yeah, but these things you don't think about when you buy a house, what's due south, do you? When you moved in, did you think, oh, that's due south, I'll be able to do some good observing?
We had a nice sunny back garden.
Yes.
Got a nice sunny patio. To be honest, I've kind of shot myself in the foot because back in the year 2000, I planted a tree in the garden. And it's now bigger than the house, and I'm thinking I'm going to have to get a tree surgeon in to cut this back because it's starting now to impede on me.
Phil, did you plant it?
I don't want to cut it down.
Did you plant it for the millennium then? Is it?
Yeah.
It's
a nice tree.
Well, it sounds like its days are numbered. So going back to this Milky Way then, who actually first worked it out? I think, is it Galileo by any chance?
William Herschel.
Is it?
Well, the Greeks knew about it, and they named it the Milky Way because it's the milky colour.
It does.
It's a milky streak across it, and it's exactly what, and the Greeks made the terminology. But the guy that actually worked out what it was William Herschel back in the 1700s. And he found a huge amount of interstellar objects, like star clusters and galaxies. They didn't know what they were, but he did notice there was a lot of stars in a belt around the sky. And he actually drew and worked out the shape of the galaxy back in the 1700s. But they had no idea what it was. And it ended up, it's our galaxy that we live in. And all these extra little fuzzy bits are outside of our galaxies and the galaxies in their own right. And it wasn't until about 100 years ago, and I'm only talking 100 years ago, that people then realised when they were measuring distances of stars, somebody said, hang on a minute, these fuzzy objects are like way, way further away than the stars in our galaxy. And then they realised, the penny dropped, these galaxies are islands of stars, and we live in one of them islands of stars, what we call our galaxy.
Wow.
So, yeah. But then a lot of other stuff's in our galaxy, that's a lot closer, obviously, and it's in the spiral arms and the bulge. We've only really understood it for the past 100 years.
Amazing.
Before that, it was just like we were the centre of the galaxy and everything revolved around us. And now it doesn't, we're insignificant in the darkness of the cosmos.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So you as a club, as an astronomy club, are you generally not, you're not interested in the Milky Way in its entirety? You're interested in nailing down the things that you can't see with the naked eye?
Yeah. To be honest, it's nice to take a wide field shot of the light Cygnus because you can see the spiral arm that runs through the galaxy, through this constellation, and there's some lovely star formations inside of it, and there's some lovely hydrogen alpha gas clouds like the North American Nebula, and which you can see with your naked eye on a really dark location. But then if you try and take photographs of some of the nebula and some of the, there's also planetary nebulas, clusters. There's some amazing objects in there as well as just as well as, and there's also quite a few star clouds from exploded stars. I think is it 52 Cygni. There's a star called 52 Cygni in Cygnus, and there's a cloud from a past supernova explosion, and it's a massive cloud of gas, roughly in a circle, and this star lights part of the filament up, and it's a really good skill to be able to photograph the actual filament of the gas illuminated by the star. Last year, I just managed to pick it up with my DSLR camera with an 8-second exposure, but this year I'm going to try and do like a half an hour exposure with my new camera to try and see how good it is.
You know, you can. You said you could see this hydrogen alpha gas clouds with the naked eye. For an amateur, what would that look like? Why would you be able to see it?
It's a bit like a cloud. It's a cloud illuminated by stars.
Oh, so, okay.
You know, like you get the Orion Nebula, it's a star formation area. So you've got some stars in a cloud. The stars excite the gas. The gas is excited and it glows. And you also get reflection from the gas as well. So that also glows. So, but the Orion Nebula is quite close. Some of these objects are further away and a bit dimmer, which is why you don't see them as well. But if you're in a dark site, you can see them pretty good.
Pretty well. Can I just ask you, because I'll have to let you go in a bit, but do things within the Milky Way, they're never constant then, they're always changing? In terms of stars forming and dying? And
Yeah. Well, we're all spinning around the galaxy, so we're moving all the time. But it's really difficult to perceive the movement. It takes a long, long time for things to perceivably move. There are some closer stars which we can see moving through time over several decades. And there's a star in the constellation of Orpheus. And I did a photograph of it last year, and I'm going to try and take another photograph this year and build up a log to see if you can actually move in it against the background stars. There are the odd star that is relatively close, and I'm not saying relatively close, it might be 8 or 10 light years away, that are moving quite fast, and you can see them move against other stars. So, but there's not many. But wow. So yeah, it's a thing to do. The other thing I'd like to do is try and photograph the centre of the galaxy to see what it looks like from an amateur point of view, because there's a supermassive black hole at the centre of our galaxy, and it's in the constellation of Sagittarius. I think it'd be really good stab at it. I'll not be able to see it.
No, but your never-ending list. Your never-ending list of challenges, for things to see.
Yeah, asking a photograph in the area.
I know. Anyway, hopefully you've dried out now, thank Phil. You. Thanks for coming to talk to us yet again.
Thank you.
We shall speak to you soon. All right.
See you next month.
Bye-bye, Phil.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.